Welcome to Season 2, Episode 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday the 13th of April, and I'm Tony. With me this week are Alan. How are you doing, Al?
Yeah, not bad, actually. Yeah, good to be back.
What have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
Fixing a duff disk in my desktop.
Another one?
Well, yeah, I seem to get through them.
A lot of disk-related issues in your house.
Yes.
Is it because you live next to a giant magnet?
No, I think it's actually having two very small children. I blame them. I think they get up in the middle of the night and
administer your systems.
And RF my discs.
Poke biscuits into your Drobo.
Actually, they did put crayons in my PC once. That was the cause of one disc failure, was crayons in my disc.
Excellent.
And with so many discs running, you're bound to lose the odd 10 or so, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And how are you doing, Simon?
Yeah, very well.
What have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
G-Podder is the main thing. Actually, in fact, no, it's not. G-Podder I found, I had not used it before. I've been using MashPodder, which is a command line app for downloading...
MashPodder?
Podcasts. Yeah.
Downloading podcasts about the Korean War.
Actually, other things.
Oh, right, okay.
G-Podder and Drupal. Actually, I've been working on Drupal a lot and getting that going. A new blog.
Why are you using G-Podder when you last week said you wanted to do everything without the mouse?
Good question, actually. No,
was this on your Crunchbang machine, or was this...?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So what is it about G-Podder that makes it so good?
I don't know, actually. It looks... I've got a GUI. I've been using the command line with MashPodder. That's fine. And G-Podder just has got... looks nice.
And Drupal for your website?
Yeah.
What was the reason for that?
I've never really... No, I have used it, but I've never administered it. Right. So I've started with a vanilla installation, and where can it go?
And you're doing a multi-site thing? Or did you try and do that, or...?
I haven't. I've gone for just a base install, and then I might multi-site later on. Maybe. We'll see.
Well, we've got an interview with Emma Jane Hogbin, who's a Drupal whiz, later in the show, so that kind of fits in with that. Laura, who's sitting in for Dave this week, what have you been up to?
I've been on holiday for about a week, so...
Yay,
excellent. Yeah, the only contact I've had with Ubuntu in the last couple of weeks really has been my Ubuntu travel adapter, which is great. You can get it from the Canonical shop. It's fantastic. It's a travel adapter. It's got Ubuntu printed on it.
So did you take your travel adapter with you, Laura?
I took my travel adapter, and Tony took his travel adapter.
You have one each.
We have one each, yeah.
His and hers travel adapters.
Nice.
The best thing about them is they've got a little USB module for them, so you can charge USB devices.
Is one male and one female?
No.
Oh, okay.
Sadly. But yeah, so you can charge your phone or your
MP3 players, which is handy, because we didn't have a laptop to charge them.
So that's basically it.
Cool.
No, I know. I was very brave and went without any.
He was going to take his Asus Aspire.
Yeah, the Aspire one. Yeah.
So we're going to have an hour podcast of you telling us about the Norwegian fjords.
Yes.
Yes.
They're very rocky.
Tune out now, listeners.
Yeah.
Press stop now.
Okay. Well, what have we actually got in the show this time?
Well, the first chunk is called "Watching Paint Dry," which I know doesn't sound exciting,
but it will be when we get to it.
We hope so.
Next up, we're going to have an interview with Robbie from Category 5 TV.
Yes.
And we're going to discuss what's been happening in the Ubuntu ecosphere.
Ecosphere?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what that is. Something to do with Alan.
All right, okay. Well, of course, we're going to cover the news and other events that have been going on.
We've got an interview, as Tony said, with Emma Jane Hogbin.
And we've got your feedback.
I mentioned earlier that I've got a disk that failed in a desktop at home. And because I use Linux software RAID, I've been watching the RAID mirror rebuilding a lot. And there's a file called /proc/mdstat, which you can watch with a program called Watch.
Ah.
And it tells you how long it's got left until the RAID array is rebuilt. And I found myself watching this somewhat compulsively over the last few days, to the point where I actually, even though it says I've got 40 minutes left until the RAID array is finished, I still sit there and watch it. And I wondered if...
You don't go and make a cup of tea or anything?
I do. Yeah. I'll go and make a cup of tea, but then I do come back to it. I won't go and do something else for 40 minutes. I will actually waste my time staring at that rebuilding. Even to the point where when the console screensaver kicks in and the screen goes black, I have to hit the control key to wake it up again so I can carry on watching it. And I wondered if anyone else had this weird compulsive behaviour where they have to watch percentage things.
I don't know. You've got to be pretty sad to make it match that, I think.
Yeah, I guess.
But I think we have some pretty sad listeners in that regard.
Okay. A way to win them over, Laura.
So you're going to have a long stint on this show.
Well, I asked, what pointless progress or status screens do you watch obsessively? And Colin McD says he watches the pre-scaling theme images quite a lot with Mythbuntu.
Ah, that's probably not his fault.
Ah, yes, yes. That,
if you change resolution, is that?
Yeah, if you change resolution or change the theme, even by one pixel, it recalculates all the images and rescales them. There must be vector versions in there. And that can take a long time on a slower machine.
Though, to be fair, it doesn't tell you how long it's going to take, so you can't really leave it.
No, it's true.
Is it one of those bars that goes across and then starts at the beginning?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, oh, several times. Nice. I guess once for each image or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's understandable.
Mike Basinger said he stares at Conky sometime. What's Conky?
It's a sort of graphical system usage meter. It's on OpenBox,
isn't it? Yeah, it's on OpenBox. It's text as well. You can get it to update, and you can get what your process is doing, your hard drive, your swap space, and everything's doing. So you can sit and watch that. And yeah, I've been known to do that a bit.
Yeah, he likes to watch his memory and CPU usage for no good reason.
Yeah, been there.
Pointless.
Doubly gets a favourite of mine as well.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, that gives you time as well. You still sit there and watch the next bar come across.
What about FSCK?
You never want to see those though, do you? I find that I don't want to watch that in case it's something horrible comes up.
So the one thing that might actually be useful to you in terms of entering a system you don't want to watch.
I'm in denial about those. I don't want to see them.
Right, okay. What else we got, Laura?
Michael Douglas.
What? The Michael Douglas?
I don't think it's the Michael Douglas. He says the longest one is Windows installing.
Ooh.
39 minutes remaining.
Lies. Yeah. Complete lies.
Sits on 39 minutes for about an hour and a half.
Yes.
Watching torrents download. It's like normal downloads, but slower. That's Sheep Eating Taz on Twitter.
Which is the torrent client it's a GUI torrent client. It shows you like a bitmap of the bits of the file it's got and the ones it hasn't got and the ones that are available but it hasn't yet downloaded. And that's great because you can see them changing colour as it works out which bits it can get, and as it downloads them they all go green and you get stuck there with one red pixel in the middle of it.
You've got it bad.
Yeah. I don't know, but on Windows I used to watch the Discfrag.
The defragger. Excellent. Hugo said that actually the other day when I mentioned it to him. He said he used to watch the Windows defragger a lot.
Yeah.
Well, this doesn't really surprise me. The things that I end up watching a lot of are encoding processes, audio or video encoding stuff. And you sit there waiting for it to 21 seconds, 20 seconds, 25 seconds, and something else kicks in. Never really works to time. But I spend quite a lot of time doing that.
So there's a difference there, though, between having to watch something, like having to watch the prescaling thing on Mythbuntu and actually choosing to watch it.
Because
the colours are pretty.
You could go away. You could tell it's going to take at least an hour and go and do something useful and come back. But no, you spend an hour on the computer watching it with one eye, but sort of checking IRC, checking your Twitter, going on Facebook, whatever it might be, and just suddenly the hour's gone and, you know, you could have been spending time with real people in the real world, but no, we'd rather watch a ASCII status bar crawl slowly across our screens.
I am actually SSH to my machine at home. We're at Tony's house and I've SSH to my machine at home. I'm actually watching the MD stat update now while we talk. Yeah, I can't.
How far has it got?
He's got about 10 minutes left.
Wow. Are you going to run home at the end of the 10 minutes and kill another disc with a crayon?
Just so you can watch it again.
Yeah, I'll get the kids to insert crayons into my machine.
Has it changed?
Yes. Don't worry. I will keep everyone up to date, apprised of the state of my disc resyncing.
That's the joy of doing this live.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, it's moved. Yes, there we go.
And the final comment we've had from Andy Lochran, who says that what he waits for is the next UUPC release.
Oh.
I think it goes to the website, hits F5.
Yeah, what a creep. Thanks, Andy.
I recently a few months ago discovered an online TV show, if you like, called Category 5, and I got chatting to the guy who presents it, the main guy, and he really focuses a lot on Ubuntu, and so I thought it'd be good to get him on and have a chat to him about it.
Okay, and he's on the line now, is that right?
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Hiya, and it's Robbie, is that correct?
Yeah, Robbie Ferguson here.
Robbie Ferguson, how you doing?
Great, how about you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. So tell us about Category 5. Why did you start it?
Was that why?
Yeah, why?
Why? Well, you know what? To be honest with you, I ran an IT firm up here in Canada. We're in Ontario, Canada, and we saw a lot of, just like any computer business, a lot of people wanting support for their computers, wanting to experiment with open source software, but not trusting the fact that they don't necessarily have support for those pieces of software.
Right.
A lot of these people, though, wanted support for free, right? So the problem that we were running into as a company was that I wanted to be able to support these things. I wanted to be able to install Ubuntu Linux on somebody's computer and provide them with support, at least professional level support, but in such a way that they didn't have to pay for it, or that we could do it in such a way that they could tap into a resource of Ubuntu support or open source support. So we started Category 5 as kind of like a TV show style podcast, if you will. We broadcast live. And so that way, as those calls came in, I could start saying, just tune in on Tuesday nights. And you can probably hear my kids screaming like a monster in the background there.
Sorry, there's cats roaming around here.
But we, basically I started taking those calls and started saying, every Tuesday night you can catch me at 7 o'clock our time. And then we started seeing local people tuning in to get support for these open source pieces of software. And then it transcended the software into using digital cameras, what's the best kind of printer to purchase, those kinds of things as well.
So is it sort of tutorials that you do?
We started out that way. We started with PC Linux OS and looking at, various, when Barrel Project was the thing, we were looking at, how to install those things, how to make them work on your standard computer. But then we grew into, as the viewer base grew, we started getting a lot more emails. We started getting phone calls, during the broadcast, and decided to actually take it one step further and turn it into like a call-in help show. So that's what it grew into.
So people ask questions and you kind of have some cojones to try and answer the
that's what they tell me.
To try and answer the questions there and then. I mean, that's some feat, because sometimes people throw real curveball and tricky questions.
Yeah, well, I've been doing it for, it's been 80, we're in our 82nd week now, so, as you get into it, after 40 or so episodes, and they're one-hour episodes, you really start to get used to having to be on your toes and having to be on the ball, and you just can't be afraid to say, you know what, I'm sorry I can't help you with that, because I don't know. If you're afraid to admit that you don't know something, then that's where, it just doesn't work. So
totally. But you also have like the forums to back that up as well, don't you? So if you then you can forward them to the forums, can't you?
Yeah, our community has been growing. Certainly, the number of people who visit our website doesn't even come close to the number of people who view the show, and that's because we broadcast live through Ustream. We broadcast, we simulcast after the fact with our podcasts on various formats to Miro Internet TV and iTunes and RSS and XML and everything that you can get your hands on. So we have a lot more viewers than there are active people in the forums, but the forums have grown into a place where viewers can kind of help people kind of take it one step beyond the show and interact with the other viewers. So
it sounds like you're a bit of a video and audio geek then.
I started out, I started doing internet-based video production with Real Media way back when I was 16 or 17 years old. So we were creating, this was a software project online, kind of one of the first pilot projects where we did a virtual tour of, where you can point and click on various areas of a theme park. So you're walking through the theme park, using old school Real Media technology on dial-up internet. So, so that has grown into, then I was working in radio for several years before I got into IT support. And, so this is my way of getting back into media as well. Yeah.
So your podcast now weighs in about 700 meg download for one episode, doesn't it?
For the H.264 feed, which is 480p, and it's a one-hour broadcast, of course. So, it's about 700 megs for the high resolution, like the 640 by 480.
So that's quite a leap from dial-up real audio.
Oh, yeah. And just the interaction. I mean, we get calls and email, people joining us in the chat room from all over the world. And you can see that even we've got over 100 viewer testimonials on our website that people just go onto the site and just tell us what they think of the show. And you can see each week we get them just from all over the world. It's quite incredible that way.
So how do you put the show together? Have you got a studio at home, or do you take over a spare bedroom or something like that?
It sort of started as my home office, because I was self-employed, and so the home office was the starting point. And so we basically, when I started this thing back in late 2007, it was just me and a webcam, basically, kind of thing. So then obviously we've grown since then. Since then, basically, we've just turned the basement of my house into a television studio, which is always growing and always changing. So,
yeah, you've got multiple. I see you've got multiple cameras, and you have the desktop that you switch to as well.
We have an Ubuntu, what we call a demo system. So it's always running the latest version of Ubuntu as far as the actual releases go, and then we're able to switch from different camera angles to a view of the desktop, and we use Compass Fusion to be able to zoom in and out, so that people who are watching on low resolution feeds, say 320 by 240, they're able to see the things that are happening on the screen. And it's been a really good tool for people to use as a resource for learning how to use Linux.
One of our listeners, Colin McCarthy, has asked how on earth you find the time to do Category 5 TV. He finds it's difficult to get the time to watch it, never mind make the show.
that's true enough, but see, the advantage when I started this thing is that I was, like I said, self-employed in this field, right? So as we were starting it, it was a part of my company. So basically my company was the grand sponsor, if you will. Like, we dedicated so much time per week to preparing for the show and answering viewer questions and things. And then there's also the fact that because it's, you know, every Tuesday night, it's a set allocated time every week, and we're faithful. We've never missed an episode in 82 weeks. Wow. Because of that, it becomes a part of your weekly routine, right?
So you said it's Tuesday night. When exactly does it air?
Well, it's live. Different for you, and Alan could tell you, but it's...
this whole time zone thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's 7 o'clock Eastern time on a Tuesday night here. If you go to our website, category5.tv, up in the top left, we always have convert to your own time zone, so that will automatically figure out what time the broadcast airs in your time zone as well.
It's going to be about 1 or 2 in the morning generally, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about I've sat up till midnight and watched it, and... Then regretted it the next morning, but
but you can still get it as a download afterwards.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of users, a lot of viewers are using Miro Internet TV. It's a great open source package that works on all platforms, basically. So that's a great way to get it. You can subscribe to our RSS with any feed aggregator. So. Yeah, we make it as available as we possibly can, because for us, it's a free service, right? So for us, it truly is about the viewers and answering viewer questions and making sure that it's accessible to the viewers, even so much as we even convert the show into audio-only format, and we have a podcast that's just an audio recording in MP3 format of the actual show. So a lot of people listen to it in the car, or if they've just got an MP3 player or whatever, places where they can't view the show, they just listen to it.
Excellent.
Robbie, bearing in mind that's 82 weeks now, and the workload, something that's dear to our heart, why are you doing it?
Why are you still doing it? What
is your motivation? Obviously, you know, you're providing a great service. What's your motivation behind, you know, all the effort that you're putting into the show?
Mm-hmm. Honestly, it's every single viewer. It's a very interactive show. I think you'll see if you watch the show that I really do my best to try to take the time for each person, and I really want people who don't, you know, who maybe are intimidated by Linux or who are intimidated by technology in general, I want them to feel that they've got somebody who's kind of an advocate for them, somebody who's not out to take their money, because we do this for free, is somebody who's able to answer their questions at a level that is on par with their where they're at with computers, but at the same time, it's not condescending. So, you know, I really put an effort into helping the underdog, if you will, people who really get taken advantage of in this field.
Yeah, sure.
Too often. So, and I see that a lot because of the industry that I work in is, you know, a lot of, you know, computer retailers and things, you get them, they'll just sell you whatever the highest commission is.
Yeah.
So really it still is, you know, we want to be able to help people so that they make wise purchase decisions, so that they know that there's open source alternatives to commercial software. And I'll be honest with them, if I think that one particular piece of software is going to work better for them, I'm not afraid to say that. So it's not all about Ubuntu, but it does often come back to Ubuntu, and that seems to be my recommendation.
That's good to hear.
Great, yeah, good man.
Yeah. The other thing you've been doing recently was submitting an entry for the Free Culture Showcase for the included content on the Ubuntu CDs for the next release for Jaunty. And you won, I believe, the video category, is that right?
Yeah, how awesome is that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So
no fault of my own. I think it was the night before the contest was about to end, and I got a message on the IRC chat room for my show from Alan Pope. And says, "Have you got your entry in there for video yet?" And I think was the night before. He had mentioned it to me before that, but I just hadn't gotten around to it. And in the back of my head, I was like, I really want to participate in this, but Category 5 is a live show. We're completely live, completely uncut, unedited, unscripted. So what can I do in the Free Culture Showcase that is even partly reasonable, you know, like,
yeah,
what can I give to that project? So I gave it a little bit of thought and finally decided, you know what, I'm just going to be myself. I'm just going to sit in front of the cameras and just say what I think about the Ubuntu community. And from my experience, I mean, I started out with Linspire back in 2001. I've gone through many different distributions since then and have settled on Ubuntu. So I know a little bit about how different communities react to new users and things like that. So I really wanted to stress that the Ubuntu community, from what I can see, is really an exceptional community. A lot of people that just want to help. I mean, people like yourselves. I mean, why do you do this, right?
A good question.
Yeah, well, it's the spirit of community, and that's kind of what I went with. So I just said it like I felt it, and no script, threw it together and put it up, and I guess they decided that was what they were looking for.
Did you find it difficult to get an entry that was within the constraints of the competition? Because it's quite a small file size.
Yeah, it was like, I think it was like 2.5 megabytes.
Yeah, 2.5 meg, something like that. Yeah.
Which, I mean, I haven't worked with a file that small since 1982, you know? Like, that wouldn't have even fit on a floppy disk. So, yeah, that was kind of something else. But I was working with Ogg Vorbis. So, unfortunately, because the file did have to be, I think it was either 2.5 or 3.5 megabytes, and I'm used to working within, you know, the gigabyte range for our videos, I had to take it back, so, you know, we scaled it down to 320 by 240 and things like that. So, but it worked out, and I think I hit it right on the button.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on your win for that competition.
And yeah,
it's going to be a bit bizarre, I suspect, seeing your own work on sort of millions of CDs as they get printed and duplicated around the world.
I think if you know, if people actually go into the folder and bring that up, and like we did it, and I didn't mention the name of the show or anything in the video, but I think people will probably type it into their favorite search engines and stuff and come across our site, and hopefully that'll lead to them getting some support from Category 5.
Okay, so where can people find out more about Category 5?
It's just right on our website, category5.tv, that's the number 5, just like the cable, category5.tv.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you for talking to us, Robbie.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Cheers, Robbie.
All the best. Cheers.
Right, we get through loads and loads of information when we're preparing for the show, not all of which is sort of newsworthy, but there's stacks of stuff going on in the Ubuntu ecosphere, as we called it. We thought we'd cover some of those things right now.
Yeah.
Cool.
The first thing is that there's a new version of Ubuntu Tweak, which, am I right in thinking that's the cruft remover as was?
No.
No?
No.
What is Ubuntu Tweak then?
It's a third-party thing, so it's not created by Canonical or an internal kind of project. It's a third-party app that you add on.
Right.
And if you think of like the Windows XP Tweak.
Tweak UI.
Tweak UI, that kind of thing. It does similar kind of stuff like that. It exposes settings that you wouldn't normally find buried somewhere.
Mm.
And it also does some things like, allows you to biscuit
attack.
Hobnob went down the wrong way. It allows you to do stuff like install certain third-party apps that aren't in the repository. So a few people have pointed out there's a bit automatics, like, which has made people a bit scary, but it's actually really quite neat.
And the key thing is that in this new version, they've added support for removing old kernels.
Yeah, it's something people, a lot of people ask for. When you upgrade, you end up with all these old kernels kicking around.
Is it potentially dodgy? Can you do some things with it that you really wouldn't want to do?
Well, I guess, you know, if you get rid of all your old kernels and your system no longer boots, and you try and go back to one of the old kernels, then that, yeah, might be a degrade. But, yeah, you actively have to, you know, choose to do that. And it seems pretty straightforward. And it also uses nice things like something called Policy Kit. I think it uses Policy Kit, which is a nice authentication frameworky thing, so that it doesn't ask you for your pseudo password. It asks you for someone who has rights to do this kind of thing, which is quite nice. So it's more forward looking and not using kind of legacy ways of doing stuff. It's quite nice.
I've never quite understood why there hasn't been some sort of automatic cleanup of old kernels in Ubuntu anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there are reasons for not removing a kernel as a fallback, always having something that you can fall back on. But if you've got an installation that you've upgraded from release to release to release, you can have, you know, 16 kernels, particularly as there are kernel releases, as bug fixes happen, within the release life cycle for a particular release.
So it's worth installing just for that one feature alone?
I tend to do it by aptitude, by searching
for... Well, yeah,
but it's
for
a pain.
Your average user, you know, who doesn't know aptitude, doesn't know command line stuff, it's got a nice front end to it, it looks nice, and it's pretty straightforward.
But is there some reason that I'm missing, that there isn't an automatic cleanup of old kernels?
Nobody's written it yet.
Okay. Well, if anybody's got any other reasons, then let us know via the usual routes. Next thing is that Dr. Mo, on the WordPress blog, has talked about... is Ubuntu, the Ubuntu manga, which is now translated into English. Now, I'm not a huge manga person, but it's sort of Japanese cartoon art, isn't it?
Yeah, there was this manga cartoon in Japanese, and it was the story is about three system admins who are trying to promote the use of Ubuntu. And it's an acquired taste, obviously, manga. I'm not a particular fan, mind you. I've never really gone out there looking for manga, so... But it's you know, another way of promoting Ubuntu to a different audience, really.
Wasn't there something about people promoting Ubuntu in cartoon form in Africa as well?
Oh, God, yeah. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe it is a way of, you know, disseminating information without great big reams of text and CDs. I don't know.
Google had a whole marketing campaign around a cartoon strip.
That's true, yeah.
Google Chrome, yeah.
Yeah. That was really, really well done with a multi-million dollar US company, but with, you know, a couple of blokes doing a manga cartoon is a bit different. But, yeah, you know, more power to them.
Yeah, absolutely. So presumably it was in Japanese first and they've now translated it to English.
Yeah, the guys, we'll post a link in the show notes to all of these, but, he translated a lot of it to English. A few people got together and translated it.
And the same person has also come up with the idea of a GUI... Loco remote support tool thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether he came up with the idea for it or whether it partially existed already.
Right, but, okay.
Yeah, the idea is you have a remote support tool so you can, you know, request support from someone in your local community group, and they can remotely control your machine via some secure method, and to try and wrap that up in a nice application so it's not, you know, having to SSH tunnel and run VNC and open ports and all that kind of horrible stuff that you have to do to remotely support someone.
Because we talked all about various remote administration things during the last season, didn't we? And there were just option after option, hundreds of packages to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, there are a few, but none of them are really as straightforward as he's trying to aim for. Something where you can just say, press a button and say, I need support. And there's a list of people who could support you that maybe have ratings next to them, or people who've done this before and have qualifications next to them or something. And, you know, you choose someone who's online, they press, yes, I'll help you. And, you know, it all just works. I think that's the target. And we have seen some of these, like the Crossloop one we mentioned before for Windows. But this one for Linux should be good. He's actually looking for funding, which is an interesting thing. It's an open source community effort, but he's actually asking for donations, which maybe a bit twitchy initially, what the donations would be for.
Yeah, I mean, some projects have donate buttons on their websites, don't they? Well, things on SourceForge and what have you. But, yeah, I can see why some people are uncomfortable with it.
Mm. It's not like, well, I don't know whether there's any cost involved other than getting coders to write the thing and convert the stuff.
Well, that's it. Maybe there's the sort of bounty idea, you know, sort of set some ideas up and get people to... achieve those objectives.
It's potentially a strong community builder if it's building sort of trust and that among people who wouldn't ordinarily get support from a community.
Yeah, and helping direct people towards, you know, people who are volunteering. Because I know there are people out there running Ubuntu who just don't know that we exist, that us community people exist. They're flying blind, you know.
Yeah, so it's a really big thing. Lots of people that do need the support. Hopefully it'll take off, you know, trusted people that can essentially get into your system and help you where you need it.
Yeah, I mean, Alan was just having a phone call with his wife during a recording break trying to fix out a problem, and it'd be great to have had a button that she could just press and get remote support from somebody else in the loco when you're off recording podcasts.
I'm not sure I would like that. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah,
he likes to feel his wish.
Yes.
I also, in the spirit of giving, Phil Bolt from the Ubuntu documentation team is looking for help getting an Ubuntu installation guide together.
Yes, he wants to get this done for 9.10 in time for Karmic, so not within the next 6 months.
Karmic?
Karmic Koala is the nickname for 9.10. Yes, after Jaunty Jackalope, which is the next one, Karmic Koala. Yeah, he looked on the stats for the wiki, for the community wiki, and saw that of the top 20, 7 of the top most accessed pages are to do with installing. So clearly there's a void there of, you know, people who are void of knowledge, in fact, of people who can't install it or have difficulty installing.
What sort of things do they have difficulty with? Have you looked at them?
I've looked at the list, and the top page on the community wiki is how to burn an ISO image.
That old chestnut.
Yeah.
I remember posts to mailing lists about that from, you know,
years ago.
10 years ago probably.
Yeah.
You know, people who've managed to copy the ISO onto a CD and have a beautiful file.
But no way of booting it. Totally. Yeah, there's others, like, you know, how to actually install it using the alternate CD, how to install it from the live CD and all the options. And yeah, it seems like an admirable goal to create an installation guide.
Is he looking for community involvement?
Yes, absolutely. He's posted a message and created a specification on Launchpad, and there's a wiki page with details about what, you know, is planned to go in it. I think he's looking for people to help out who can. I don't think you even need that much deeply technical skills. You just need to be able to, you know, type stuff off in an Office document,
and also proofread as well. You don't need to be able to get into the technical side. Just proofreading, somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. And try the stuff out.
Testing.
All the tutorials and you know, any documentation that's in there that's got any, you know, how-tos. Someone's got to test them.
This will be a proper dead tree book.
I don't know. Probably a guide on the website, but I see no reason why it couldn't be converted into a PDF or something and then through Lulu or one of those websites turned into a dead tree book.
Cool. Okay. Corey Contrast from the artwork team, and who also works on Ubuntu Studio, who I think we interviewed again Series 1 at UDS in Prague, suggested that all the artwork created for Ubuntu should be crafted only using free software tools, which sparked off something of a mildly heated discussion on the mailing list about it. And I think the conclusion was that there would be no sort of mandate on the tools that people use to generate their artworks and things, but some guidelines towards using free file formats would be created. But it's a debate that's happened before, I think, around the Free Culture Showcase, where people were, you know, some people thought it should have to use free software tools like the GIMP and all those sort of relevant related products, and only submit in free formats and what have you. And I think this time around they had to submit in free format, but not necessarily create the artwork or whatever in a free software package.
I think I can see a valid argument. You know, if you're creating a free software product, the content in that free software product, should it have been created using that free software?
Or is it about freedom of choice? Like, these archetypes, you know, they just want to get on with their getting on. It's not necessarily down to the product that they use to make it, surely.
But also, if the software isn't ready yet at a level where you can use it, then you're actually inhibiting people from doing things.
Well, I think Corey's argument was the tools that we have available, like Inkscape, GIMP, and so on, actually are able to do stuff like create icons, create backdrops, you know, coloured themes and stuff, all the kind of things that the artwork team do. The tools we have actually can do it. And that's been proved by, you know, he does it using free software tools. So, you know, I could see the argument, but I can see the other side where they say, well, look, I already use this tool on a daily basis, and I know this tool. It's non-free. It uses non-free formats, but so long as I convert it to a format you can understand.
And also, if you mandate the use of free software tools, then you're potentially cutting off a whole swathe of people who could be involved but can't be because they're not familiar with those tools.
Yeah.
Now, you can try and help them to get the use of the new tools and to learn those packages and blah, 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 but you're still reducing, effectively, the number of people who can get involved.
Yeah, totally.
And so the debate goes on.
Yes, that's never-ending. Yeah. That one.
Well, we just like to point out that we do use free software for making this podcast, just to rub that in a little bit.
Like, the final one really is... actually, it's all about...
There's another one.
Oh, is that? All right, go on. Right, well, look, Jaunty.
Penultimate one.
The penultimate is the fact that Jaunty is so fast to boot.
Yeah. We had this debate about whether it was worthwhile booting fast or not.
I've noticed it, but I haven't got a stopwatch on it. But I certainly don't need to go make a brew now.
Yeah. Install boot chart. Install boot chart.
Okay.
And then every time you boot the machine, it creates a picture in some directory buried var log boot chart or something like that.
Is it a free format?
Yeah.
Excellent.
.png, PNG.
Okay.
And... actually, on Jaunty, it zips it up as well. It tarred gazips it, because you end up with lots of them.
Lots of free formats.
And, three formats, three levels.
Three free formats.
And it creates a picture, which is like a timeline of your boot process. And there's a graph at the top showing you CPU utilization and a graph underneath showing you I.O., I think. And then as time progresses, you see all the processes that start up. And so you can see peaks and troughs where certain processes start and delays and stuff. And so I think they've used boot chart as a way to figure out what the delays are and squish that down a bit. But you can see how long your machine, without a stopwatch,
right.
You can see how long it takes because it tells you at the top how many seconds.
Cool.
George Castro, who posted a blog entry about it, said he got his in less than 10 seconds.
Yeah, something like 7.5 seconds to boot a machine.
That's not enough time to even open the tea caddy, is it?
No. The kettle wouldn't have boiled by then, would it?
And the last thing that we were going to talk about was Rhythmbox, the music player that everybody loves, the default music player in Ubuntu since day one.
Not everybody loves it, I think you'll find.
I think the fact is that everybody does love it. It's fantastic, and I'm sure no readers will email in and contradict me with that.
Can I email in?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too, actually.
But basically, the main developer has said, it's not worth it anymore. I'm giving up. I'm going home. So he's not going to do any more development work on Rhythmbox.
It seems that way, yeah.
So what happens then?
That's a good question. It's for Ubuntu, they don't take it lightly, the switch from one app to another. You know, there's very few. You know, they've not switched, for example, from Evolution to Thunderbird, or they've not switched from Firefox to Epiphany. You know, there's some big apps that they haven't switched. But I don't know of many apps that have kind of development has stopped or, you know, slowed.
I suppose in the spirit of freedom and open source, somebody else could actually pick it up and crack on with it.
That's if the whole they wanted point, to.
Yeah.
What was his reason for stopping?
I don't know, actually. You can read it in the link on the mailing list. It's actually back in February this year. But I think he basically said it wasn't worth his while to carry on. Maybe because other competing products out there do the same kind of thing, and it's not worth him re-implementing all those features in Rhythmbox when other tools do it.
That's fair enough.
Mm. Yeah.
The death of an open source project?
Well, is it dead? You know, it still compiles, still runs. He's still doing some bug fixes, you know.
I guess the test is if anybody thinks it's worthwhile going in and taking it over from him.
Yeah, or replacing it in Ubuntu's case. You know, in the case of this one, Rhythmbox, there's been multiple discussions at UDSs in the past of replacing it with Banshee, and that comes up with some heated debate as well, because Banshee's a mono application.
Oh.
So some people don't like it, despite the fact F-Spot and Tomboy are in Ubuntu and they're both mono. And they're both really good. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that about wraps up our tour of the Ubuntu ecosphere.
Steve McIntyre has been re-elected as the Debian project lead.
Yeah, Steve's been really helpful, I think, in trying to smooth over relations with the Ubuntu communities, with the Debian developers.
Yeah, he's a good guy, yeah.
Yeah.
According to a recent survey, about 14% of enterprises already switching to another operating system. Of those, 27% are switching to Mac and 25% to Ubuntu.
Wow.
But that is a small fraction of a small fraction of a small fraction of people.
It still comes down to about 3% of the total desktop market compared of people who are currently switching anyway.
And the Mac and Ubuntu's equivalent, nearly.
Microsoft have claimed that 96% of netbooks are sold with Windows, not Linux. And Chris Kenyon from Canonical, along with several other commentators, has debunked this as FUD, as Microsoft figures apparently based on netbooks sold through PC stores in the US and don't include online sales like Dell, for example.
Yeah. When you see that Microsoft claimed 96% of netbooks are sold with Windows, and you just look at all the EPCs that have been sold.
Statistics prove Linux. What you want them to prove.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, people believe them sometimes.
Meh.
The BBC have launched R&D TV, which is a monthly technology programme made up of interviews from knowledgeable BBC developers, BBC project experts, and experts from around the world. The good news is that it's available in freedom-loving GOG Vorbis Theora format.
And it's torrentable.
Is it any good?
I've not watched it. No. But yeah, it's good they're doing the right thing with some content available in an open format and
yeah,
you know. Sort of cribbed this from the BBC website.
Kind of. Yeah. I don't think they would put freedom loving OG format though.
Right, for those of you that just can't stand to leave the blue screen of death behind, you can now try the portable Ubuntu project. An Ubuntu system running as a Windows application. It uses the Kolinux kernel and provides an X server and even Pulse Audio.
Excellent. For all of your audio crashing goodness on Windows.
No, no, because the Pulse Audio server is running on Windows, not on the Ubuntu.
Is it better on Windows?
I don't know. But, I mean, it's actually quite good. You end up with your Windows toolbar at the bottom, and you end up with an Ubuntu toolbar at the top, and you can start Ubuntu applications and run them side by side on Windows.
So let me get straight, you could now do things like running Firefox on Windows and OpenOffice on Windows. This is insanity. It's a world I never dreamed would exist.
OpenMoco have discontinued development of the GTA 03 phone, the replacement for the FreeRunner. The company are planning to work on Plan B device, which will hopefully generate revenue for them to revive the GTA 03 again.
Apparently they've made quite a few redundancies as well. They sort of slashed the size of the company.
Oh, really?
Some of the articles, yeah.
Oh, no. Sad stuff. Yeah. I wonder if Android has anything to do with this.
What's the GTA 03 like compared with the original?
It doesn't exist.
It just never got very far.
Off the planning board, I don't think. Mm. But this new Plan B thing, the CEO was waving around, you know, this is what it will be like, and nobody really knows what it is yet.
Wait and see. Mm. Debian has started developing a version based on the FreeBSD kernel, known as GNU/K FreeBSD.
Catchy.
Yeah, I still bet it gets released before the GNU/Herd does, though.
Ooh, meow.
In a surprising move, Novell have dusted off the source for iFolder, the file synchronisation and collaboration platform. They've promised to do it right this time, focusing on building an active community around it.
Do you think this is in response to competition from Dropbox?
Alan, what do you think?
I would love to see iFolder work. I would love to throw away Dropbox and use iFolder instead. I would love to.
I tried to install it when it was sort of being neglected and there were some very dodgy Ubuntu packages that didn't quite work.
Loads of people have tried packaging iFolder. It's one of those things that it's like entering the gang. You have to try it.
I think essentially you need to package OpenSUSE for Ubuntu first.
In news sure to please Cubists, Sun has released version 2.2 of VirtualBox, the desktop virtualization software, which now supports 3D acceleration in Linux guests.
This is really cool.
Oh, good.
No, but, well, if you want to do, like, the funky effects and get the full effect of the new notification thing in Jaunty, where you get the fading and all that malarkey, if you're running Linux in a guest, of course.
I'd rather a full USB support.
Well, you can get full USB support if you download the version from Sun.
The non-free version.
Yeah. We've got some events to remind you of. We mentioned last week the release parties. There's an extra one now. So we've actually got three UK release parties.
That's really good.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? Although not quite the same as Lithuania, we've got six release parties.
Party on.
There's not much to do in Lithuania, clearly.
Yes, I think there's one in every bar in one city. Or no, they're all in different cities.
They're all sitting on their own in that bar.
Ooh. So the three we've got, one in London at the Warwick Bar. There's one in Manchester at the BBC in Oxford Road.
And that's in the northwest of England.
Yes, I mistakenly put that it was in the Midlands, but it's in the northwest. Northwest. Manchester is in the northwest, and I will get that.
And you have to pre-register to go to that one.
You do. You can either... There's a link we'll put, but you can either sign up by mailing someone, or you can say you're going to arrive via the Facebook group or something like that.
Okay.
And the third one is in Cardiff, which is actually, it's going to be at two venues, because they realise that some people are not old enough to go to a bar, or they're not happy with a bar atmosphere. So it's going to start off before 7 o'clock in the evening. It's going to be at Starbucks in Cardiff. And then after that, it's going to be at the Central Bar in Cardiff. Details on the website.
It's a nice idea.
Yeah, it's very inclusive. Good idea.
And the next round of Ubuntu Open Week will take place from Monday the 27th of April to Friday the 1st of May. There's no sessions confirmed yet, but suggestions should go to George Castro, and we'll put a link in the show notes where you can find out details about that.
Yeah, there's a kind of hidden version of the calendar you can see that's filling up already.
A secret version.
It's not that secret. You just go to the webpage and put /prep in front of it and you'll see.
And June 13th, 2009 sees the Southeast USA Linux Fest.
We played the promo for that last week, I think, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
On the way back from Fosdem, Tony and I talked to Emma Jane Hogbin in the corridor of the Eurostar train.
Perfect recording environment.
Yeah, random waiters and waitresses wandering past every so often, looking at us strangely. Mm. Emma Jane is she's a woman in open source, and she did a presentation at Fosdem about that. She, as her day job, consults on Drupal and sets up websites for people. I think she used to develop something of Drupal, and she's just about to release a book on it, and she's involved with the Linux documentation project and Ubuntu.
Yeah, and she's an Ubuntu member as well.
She is.
Laura and I are here on the Eurostar, which is why you can hear all the rattling and background noise. We're here with Emma Jane Hogbin, and we just come back from Fosdem. It was your first Fosdem, wasn't it?
It was my first Fosdem, yes.
And how did you find it?
It was an absolute amazing racket of excitement. It certainly is like no other conference that I've ever been to in terms of the self-directed development rooms, and it was pretty neat to go. And certainly Brussels is a pretty amazing city to be in as well.
And you go to a lot of conferences in a lot of places, I believe.
Yeah. This is my first out of three conferences over the next 5 weeks.
I bet most of them won't have their own fish and chip van. Sorry, chip van just outside the main door there.
It's true, yeah. Although the queue was impressive for the chip van.
So what were you doing here at Fosdem?
I was presenting in the Drupal developer room, and my talk was on using Drupal to host multiple clients from the same code base.
Because as well as doing Ubuntu stuff and being an Ubuntu member, you also do Drupal consultancy, essentially.
Yes. Most of my paid work is with Drupal. Certainly, I'm very active in the Ubuntu community, but it's more on the advocacy side as opposed to the code contributing side.
So what were you showing them in terms of multi-site?
I have a small business network with Drupal that hosts about 20 different clients, and it's a single code base, which allows me to host an evening where people all get together and learn how to update their sites, and I know that it's going to be identical in terms of their experience because it's an identical code base.
So what is it about Drupal that makes it so suitable for that sort of thing?
Mostly because I've been using it for a while, and so I'm familiar with it. One of the people in the presentation today was mentioning that WordPress does have similar functionality with their multi-site, and allows a stronger administrative capability over multiple websites. It's just a different way of doing it.
So how did your talk go down?
I think the talk went really well. One of the really neat things about Drupal is that really my talk had about 5 minutes of content and about 40 minutes of entertainment. So it really, if you have one specific thing that you know you need to accomplish, it can be very easy to explain that one thing. The trick is knowing that one thing exists. Drupal has over close to 4,000 modules, that you can drop into the core to extend and offer new functionality and that sort of thing. And the hard part is knowing which of those 4,000 modules to use and knowing how you want to set up the core to be able to plug into those different things.
Outside of your talk, were you spending most of your time in the Drupal room or elsewhere? What sort of other things did you see?
I went to 2 Postgres talks, a lightning talk on Bazaar, did some socializing. That's kind of like a session that you have to plan for, right?
Yeah.
It's an important part of the weekend. It's all about the beer and the curry.
And the curry.
When it arrives, eventually.
You're a bit of a Bazaar fan, aren't you?
I am a Bazaar fan, yeah. I find the code base is decent, and that's good. But ultimately for me, it's the support that I get from the community. And I've never once, even though I have very, very basic questions, I've never once been told to do anything more than go and improve the documentation. I've never been told to go and read the documentation. So I like that part of it.
So what do you use Bazaar for your own Drupal code and yeah. changes?
So even with the multi-site, I still have themes that are deployed for each of the clients. And I use Bazaar to track changes so that when a client says, oh no, I liked version whatever it was ago, it's really easy for me to roll back and to check what those changes were.
Okay. And now you're an Ubuntu member.
I am.
And when did you become an Ubuntu member?
I think last summer is when I first became an Ubuntu member.
And why Ubuntu?
Well, I've used Debian-based systems since 2002, I think. And went from Debian to Mepis, I think it's pronounced, to Ubuntu. And ultimately, for me, it was the easiest one to update and the easiest one to keep maintained. My upgrades have been fairly painless in terms of going from whether it's 8.04 to 8.10 or, you know, whatever that upgrade path happened to be. And again, I've generally found the... Sorry. I generally found the community to be very supportive, which is always good.
So do you use it on servers as well as the desktop?
Servers are Debian-based, not Ubuntu, and I'm using exclusively Ubuntu on the desktop.
So why did you want to become a member rather than just using Ubuntu and, you know, filing bugs or whatever?
I have been doing a lot of advocacy, and I think it's important for people to see that there are ways to contribute and become a member that have absolutely nothing to do with code. Especially as a woman in open source, I think that it is important to step up to the plate and be a role model when you're in a position to do so.
You are a woman, and you do...
It's true.
You are in open source.
Yeah, you are in open source. But you've two been given a series of talks on women in open source, especially last year. What really motivated you to do that?
My frustration with a number of the women projects is really what motivated me to do it, because I felt that the way that it's been delivered in the past has been to blame men or to blame the project the way it exists right now, and it really hasn't moved us forward at all. And I think that the presentation that I delivered last year was really about saying, if it's important to have women involved in open source, then we need to figure out how to do that. But bashing men is not the way to go about it.
Did the talk have an impact that you noticed?
Not really. I found that it was more preaching to the converted. So those who came to hear the message already knew that it was important. They knew the tools that I was presenting in terms of alternatives. I think it reached a new audience. It certainly, after the presentation at OSCON, it received slideshow of the day on slideshare.net, which is cool. But other than encourage people to stay sort of on track, I don't know that it changed anyone's way of thinking. It just supported what people already felt.
So what do you think is the next step towards sort of strengthening inclusivity or making sure people don't feel alienated from community?
The really bizarre thing for me is that women tend to cluster. So as a woman in open source, I am constantly surrounded by women in open source. And I really don't notice the gender gap as strongly as some of the men do in the project. Although certainly since my profile has been raised over the last 6 months, I've gotten a lot more personal messages, or, you know, whether they're private emails or Twitters or that sort of thing. Sorry, idents or dents, where guys are leaving comments that they would just absolutely never leave for other men. So it's interesting that the talk...
Sorry, in what way? What sort of comments?
Oh,
I mean, negative comments or positive?
The equivalent of drunk dialing, basically, where a guy is filling out a form and really, like, in one case, literally had too much to drink and thought that it was a good idea. And, you know, my approach to it is to email them back and say, that wasn't very appropriate. And I almost always get a response back going, wow, I was not sober when I did that. I am so sorry.
Clearly the Google thing where you have to type in a sum before you can send an email. But, I mean, I guess there are idiots in all walks of life.
Absolutely. It's not special to open source. Absolutely not. We don't get to claim this as our own. And that's where the Ubuntu project for me is especially interesting, because the marketing material is certainly very female positive, but the community structure has a lot of competition built into it. So the karma points on Launchpad, for example, that's very different from the Drupal community, where there's no tallying of scores. It's just a very, very different structure, and so I'm fascinated to see how these two communities progress. In the Drupal community, the co-core maintainer is Angie Byron. The head of the documentation project is Addison Berry. So there's a lot of very high-profile women, and we don't see the same thing in Ubuntu.
You're involved with a lot of non-geeky communities as well, aren't you? Like crafts things. How do you see those different? Are they different at all?
Well, I would say that knitting is very geeky.
Okay, computing.
Yeah, and in that respect, it's very interesting to see that ultimately these are people who are completely topic focused. There's absolutely no reason why there's not more men involved in the craft communities, and yet here are these two uber nerd things that are completely opposite, and there's not a gender balance in either one of them. And I don't, other than sort of the school training of, you know, girls do crafts and boys do woodshop, I'm not sure why that still exists.
My perception of going to various conferences and events over the last couple of years is that there have been a steadily increasing, but perhaps slowly increasing, number of women there. Mm-hmm. Does that seem to tally with yours?
Certainly the jokes in the toilets, because that's where, you know, women tend to congregate, is that we now have to queue for the toilets, which is certainly a step forward. But the queues aren't out the door, so really we have a ways to go yet.
You see, I would hate that. If I was a woman, that would have me excluding women on every possible ground. I'd hate to queue for anything. And for the toilet, what could be worse?
But last year at Fosdem, the men's toilets were for men, and the women's toilets were for women and men.
Yeah.
So sure, that what the disproportion in numbers were. We didn't have that this year.
And at OSCON, certainly last year, the running joke is we were all going to have name plaques for next year, because we did all have our own private stalls. So it's not perfect by any stretch.
You're also working on a book. I think it's a Drupal book, is it?
Yes, Front-End Drupal. It's coming out in April, assuming I meet all of my deadlines. And it's a book on Drupal theming, so how to create the templates that alter the design of Drupal.
So you can take a stock Drupal site and theme it up so it'll look totally different from the stock.
I can make Drupal look as ugly or as pretty as a graphic designer is able to imagine.
Okay, so will it help people do the graphic design bit, or is it about the coding the design into Drupal language?
It really is the in-between step in terms of the graphic designer, whether that also includes an interaction design component as well, and the module developer. There's a slice in between, and we're referred to as themers. And themers are not necessarily capable of developing beautiful, but we can speak both languages. So we're comfortable working in module land and comfortable working in graphic design land, but it's how those two things get combined and put into a style guide that gets applied across the site.
And you mentioned earlier that there are a lot more books about Drupal coming out at the moment. There seems to be a spate of them.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because Dries, the project lead, said that he wanted more books about Drupal.
Ah, right. and what he says goes.
Absolutely.
Do you think Drupal has really reached a level of acceptance now that it perhaps didn't have a few years ago, in the same way that, say, Joomla or WordPress have?
The interesting thing about Drupal, I think, is that at the DrupalCon, at the main conference, the core developers have asked that we stop calling it a content management system and start calling it a content management framework. So it really, at its core, isn't very sexy, isn't very attractive, but when you start plugging in one of those almost 4,000 modules, then you really can develop very sophisticated sites. And its focus is on, well, one of its focuses is on community user-generated content, and it does that very well. And there are some very large corporate names behind it now. So Sony, for example, has paid for a lot of development work, which all goes back into the community under GPL licenses. So there's some really interesting relationships between those who want things developed and the community who sort of contribute for fun.
And with 4,000 with 4,000 modules out there, as you say, there's going to be pretty much everything you can think of has going to be done by somebody.
Yes. Yeah.
Are there any sort of times where you've been stumped and you haven't been able to find something that's in a module when a client said to you, can you do this?
Yeah, web scheduling, which is really, really hard to do. And that's, people still tend to plug in the Google Calendar because web scheduling is, or web-based scheduling is really, really hard to do. And even if you look at Google Calendar, as good as it is, you're still limited to, I think it's half-hour increments. So if you have a meeting that starts at 2:15, it's not immediately obvious how you would schedule that, because it's hard.
Cafe Ninja emailed in to say that Easy Peasy was originally called Ubuntu E, not Ubuntu.
We were talking about this in the last episode, weren't we?
Yeah.
Trying to remember what it was called.
Yeah, Ubuntu is a separate distro, still going strong, which he prefers. The default config for Ubuntu works on his E701 out of the box.
That's what you've got, isn't it?
Are you using it?
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm not. I did, but then I went to Crunchbang.
No, I mean, you've got 701.
Yes.
Ah, good, cool.
Alistair McKinley emailed to say that our news article about Tux being replaced with Tuz made him panic. We should have mentioned it was only for one release cycle. We did actually mention that in our news article, but Alistair was clearly in such a panic that he missed it.
Oh, bless.
Michael Mayer mentions that our podcast causes his Sansa E200 MP3 player to crash. Has anyone else had this problem? I don't know anyone with one of those players.
No, email in if you have had.
Or send us your Sansa E.
Yes.
We can test it.
Yes. It could be something to do with the variable bitrate, I guess.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. You don't really care.
But if somebody sends me one in, I'll have a look and I'll fix it.
Good.
The Daily Telegraph technology correspondent, Dan Monsula, wrote a very nice preview of Jaunty Jackalope on his blog on the Daily Telegraph website, in which he happened to link to an interesting podcast.
Why, which podcast would that be?
I'll give you three guesses as to which podcast he might have said was an interesting podcast. Yes, it was us. So thank you for that link, Dan. It was great to see. It was a really good, interesting write-up of Jaunty and all the things it's offering, really, actually, for new users.
Cool.
Okay, Twitter IDs are made to be read, not spoken. We have @B2Ripbridge, says, though it's a contradiction in terms, what do you think is the best beginner's guide to Linux command line?
Oh, the new one from the FSF and Floss Manuals.
Yeah.
Flossmanuals.org, I guess.
Google.co.uk. Enter Floss Manuals.
Floss Manuals command line guide, yes.
Yeah.
We mentioned really it last week, I think.
Yeah. So check in the show notes for the last episode, and it's probably in there. Adam has a panic look on his
face. Check the website.
Another one from Twitter, @ApacheUK, asked, what episode of Net at Night do you guys appear on?
That's a very fine question, and one which we don't have an answer for.
Pope is Googling like mad.
Yeah. We'll come back to that one. How's about that? Simon Weirs suggests that we should talk about ways to get involved in the community, and that back in September he was trying to get into the community spirit a bit and wasn't too sure on how to get started in helping people. Now he posts on the forums, he is a regular on IRC when he gets some free time, but he'd really like some tips and tricks to help other people getting involved in the community, and he'd really like that idea. It's something that sounds actually quite interesting to do, because we're all kind of community guys rather than developers in this room, but it can be a tricky thing to get to find your feet in, really, and get established as part of a community.
There is actually a page on the Ubuntu website. If you just go to ubuntu.com, there is... I can't see my screen.
Alan's pop shield covers his face.
Ubuntu.com. On the left-hand side, there's actually a link that says Get Involved. And if you click that, there's a whole array of stuff showing how you could contribute to Ubuntu, including the usual development and that kind of stuff. But there's also writing documentation and proofreading and giving support, testing, and you know, all the other kind of stuff, all listed with links to various places on how to contribute. But yeah, maybe we should...
Is that community or is that getting involved? I mean, they're two different things, aren't they?
It's a bit like getting involved in a lug. You know, how do you get involved in that, and how do you go to a meeting and not just feel like a bit of an outsider, I guess?
You know, that's what I would suggest. If you want to get involved in the community, really, you've got to go and meet people. Mm. And going to a lug is... Certainly, that's how I started.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good way to meet people.
Cool. Okay, well, hopefully those tips are some pointers in the right direction, and maybe we can talk about it a bit more in a future episode.
And in reference to your previous question about...
Go.
Which episode of Net at Night? It was 76.
Excellent.
Which aired on the 27th of the 11th of 8.
Excellent.
Well done.
Thank you. Paul Hurst quite likes the sound of the update changes in Jaunty. This was to do with the pop-up bubble things and hiding the update.
Oh, notification. Yeah.
But he suggests it might be nice if Ubuntu had an apply updates and shutdown option. This actually works quite well in Microsoft land and keeps people well patched with little interference in their daily desktop use. Of course, this only works for people who regularly shut down the machines, but it would be a nice touch.
I don't know. If on a Windows, on an XP, I've got an XP virtual machine, and if I shut it down and I see that it says turn off or click here if you want to turn it off without installing updates, I always do that. I will never press the turn it off and do the updates. I don't know why. I don't trust it.
I'd probably only do it for a desktop machine that I was leaving, because if I'm turning off a laptop, it's because I want to unplug it.
Yeah. I've worked in offices where someone's been standing around with a laptop swearing at it, wanting it to finish doing the updates. I mean, it's their own fault for pressing the do updates on shutdown. But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, if it was an option...
It'd be an option. That'd be a good idea.
I think it would be a good idea.
About the new format. Phil Newbert just finished listening to our last episode, and the new format apparently is pure quality.
Oh, what a nice
Excellent.
Man.
Excellent.
Thanks, Phil.
That's only because we said nice things about Crunch Bang.
Simon did.
Oh.
Well, I've not used it.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's fantastic.
Oh, I can't pronounce that. Chris Guvaras? Guvaras?
That'll do.
And Jim Kerwin. Welcome us back, and we've been missed, apparently. They appreciate the time and hard work to keep at it. And appreciating us keeping at it. Hang on.
Sorry.
Maybe I should proofread these.
Yeah.
We need community members to join our podcast and proofread the stuff before I read it and sound like an idiot.
Just need our technical writer to proofread it.
Yeah. What's your job, Laura?
I think I kind of combined two tweets into one.
Basically, they're appreciative of our hard work and want us to keep at it, I think, is the gist of what they're after.
Basically.
Well, thanks, guys. It's a nice sentiment. James Eaton didn't spot any difference between the quote-unquote pre-recorded shows and the quote-unquote live shows. I think he might do this episode.
Yes.
I reckon.
A few more fluffs this week than usual.
And Colin McCarthy asks, have you ever thought of using ustream.com and doing a UUPC live?
We did, didn't we? Before we start recording this series, this season, we talked at length about doing
We had
this.
A big curry, and we talked about all sorts of wacky, crazy ideas about doing a live stream version. I kind of quite like to still, actually.
Mm.
But, you know, if people are interested in us doing it, let us know and we'll consider it. Once we get a little bit better at doing it this way, then maybe we can just look at doing a live stream. But we'll see.
And when we get some bandwidth as well.
1.5 megabit now I'm at.
Wow. What, upstream?
No.
That's one of the problems we have, is there are technical issues, and then there are also, every so often, we like a tea break.
Yeah, that's just true.
You know, biscuits.
That's what interviews are for.
Pre-recorded interviews. Play out a 15-minute interview.
I thought you meant we all go for a tea break while we're interviewing someone. That's nice.
Guest slot. Excellent. Okay, well, thank you for all your feedback, and we'll have some more next time.
So that's it. Thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica. If you'd like to get hold of us, you can email the show via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or leave 30 seconds of voicemail on 0845 508 1986.
You can send us your comments on Identica via identi.ca/UPC or Twitter, which is twitter.com/UUPC.
Alternatively, if you're into IRC, you can chat to us via the #ubuntu-uk channel on the Freenode IRC network.
And you can find us on Facebook, search for Ubuntu UK Podcast.
We welcome suggestions, material, tips, reviews or rants and feedback, both positive and negative, so please do get in touch.
Thanks also to our network of community mirrors, which we've listed on the website.
Well, we said we would, but we haven't yet.
Dave said he would.
Okay, we will.
We will get it done. That's all for this episode. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya.